Hi, this is Mark Steiner, and that was Mahalia Jackson 50 years ago today singing at the March on Washington. And, you know, one little story about that before I give us our day in history, and we're going to really focus in on the most important issues that are facing this day in history. On this day in history, when the March on Washington took place on August the 28th, Mahalia Jackson sang, and then she sat behind Martin Luther King. And while he was speaking, Mahalia Jackson was saying to him, "Martin, tell him about the dream. Martin, tell him about your dream." And that's why that was in the speech. She pushed him into telling everybody about the dream. So there's little pieces like that in this that we don't think about. It was a very complex day. And let me just very quickly, before we introduce our guest and jump into our conversation about what all the things on this day really mean to many of us in America, what they should mean to all of us in America. This day was just a juxtaposition of times. I said 50 years ago, 250,000 of us marched on Washington to demand freedom, jobs, equality in this country, blacks and whites together, male-led, I will say. Women didn't have a major role in this march, at least not publicly. And just last Saturday, we marched again to honor this day, and the struggle still ahead. And I will say one of the things that we learned from that march on Saturday, seeing all that, was that the crowd, the people who showed up from all over America, we had people who had come from Georgia, people who had come from Toledo, Ohio, people who had come from Chicago, from South Carolina, from Florida. The Dreamers came from Florida on a bus who were demanding rights after Trayvon Martin's murder and Zimmerman's exoneration. We were all there. And I would say the crowd itself was more advanced than the speakers on the platform in terms of what they wanted. 8 years earlier than 50 years ago today when we celebrate the March on Washington. 8 years earlier on that day, Emmett Till was brutally murdered in Mississippi. Brutally murdered. And we'll talk about that this hour. 45 years later to that day, Barack Obama was accepting his nomination in Denver, Colorado to run for President of the United States of America. And I was there covering it that day. And I was sitting next to a couple from Washington, D.C., from Prince George's County, in the Maryland delegation. The man was from Guyana. His wife was African-American, and we were sitting there talking together. And all of a sudden, he and I realized that we had tears streaming down our face, not because we were in love with Barack Obama. The idea that there was a black man and a black family could be in the White House was just an overwhelming emotional feeling for so many people, politics aside. That was on that day. And also it's because many years before, 1964, I had been in Atlantic City with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. I remember this incredible woman, Fannie Lou Hamer, standing up and speaking and fighting and what she meant for that day. And things were happening in Baltimore that day. On August the 28th, 1963, Gwin Oak Park was integrated. It was a mass demonstrations were taking place for weeks, for months. Schwerner Goodman and Cheney, who were murdered in Mississippi, this was one of his first demonstrations that he really marched in, was here in Baltimore at Gwin Oak Park. People came from all over. It was a huge centerpiece of what was going on. It was this demonstrations were going on all day in Cambridge, Maryland, for the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee. And another thing happened on this day on August the 28th, before we jump into our conversation, just the juxtaposition of all this. This was the day that William Zantzinger, who murdered a woman called Hattie Carroll, was exonerated. Not exonerated. He was given 6 months in jail for manslaughter. He beat Hattie Carroll to death with a cane. She was a server at the Emerson Hotel. Those of us in the civil rights movement back in 63 here in Baltimore was something it hit us like a shockwave. People even knew Hattie Carroll, who had been members of the organization, the Civic Interest Group, which is Baltimore's arm of SNCC. And Hattie Carroll was beaten to death because she didn't bring his drink fast enough. And he hit her with his cane, murdered her in the hotel. And in front of all kinds of people, in that auditorium, and he walked. Did his little 6 months, didn't even do that, and walked, and died at his home at 69 in 2009. And of course, was made famous by a Bob Dylan song, "The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll." So this day in August 28th holds a lot. I can say a great deal more, but I want to jump into our conversation with our guests. But this is a day that packs a wallop in terms of American history. We are joined here today by Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, Assistant Professor of Communications and Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland, here in Baltimore. Dr. Jared Ball, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Morgan State University, co-editor of the book Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, and author of I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifesto, and John Milton Wesley, author, songwriter, senior fellow in social marketing with the National Center for Health Behavioral Change here at Morgan State University, who grew up in Mississippi, grew up in the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement, and was the godson of the woman I talked about a minute ago, Fannie Lou Hamer, or is the godson, I should say. And welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you so much.
Good. Thank you, Mark. Great to be here.
So you're on your way and stuck in traffic, John?
Yeah, I'm making my way there, but go right ahead. I got you. I got you in my ear.
And folks, please join us here at 410-319-8888. By the way, at 10:30 this morning, we're going to be talking with Will Hagwood, who wrote the original article about the butler, a much more interesting story in many ways than the movie itself. He'll be joining us at 10:30. Don't want you to miss that. And you can actually download his article on our Facebook pages. We posted them up there for you all to download. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. So this day is a huge day. And Kay, let me begin with you. I mean, I think that – I know you're too young to be there.
Absolutely. I was not born yet, I'd like to say. Although I grew up with my father, who was there. My father was 19 years old, and he was stationed in Washington, D.C. He was a soldier.
Uh-huh.
And they were closing the base. Word had gotten around the base that they were going to close the base on August 28th, and none of the enlistees could actually leave the base. And my father really believed that was to keep African-American soldiers from going down to the march. So him and his friends signed out early. They got out on August 27th to be there at the march. So I was spoon-fed stories of the march, along with my peas and corn as a child. So I feel like there's a part of me that was there. And you mentioned Bob Dylan. I also want to make a note that he did record a song for Emmett Till about the murder of Emmett Till that was released in 1962. So I want to put that out as well.
No, he did do that. I mean, we're going to probably get that song up and play it for all of our listeners here during the course, because we're going to talk about Emmett Till as well. Because, John, I know you weren't at the march in Washington in 63, but you did live across the road from the men who murdered Emmett Till.
That's exactly right, Mark. And, you know, I think it's also important to note, too, earlier on in the conversation, that it was Lily Carroll Jackson's efforts, because prior to the Justice Department getting involved, the only investigation of the Till case had been done by Megar Evers, who at that time was field secretary for the NAACP.
So Megar Evers had come down there.
Yeah.
And took on the role as a sharecropper. He used to go around in the fields to gain information about what happened.
Yes, that's exactly right. That is exactly right. And Megar had just been killed on June 12th. So, you know, 63 was the summer of 63 was really a very significant time in the movement.
And Jared Ball, good to have you in the studio with
us. It's a pleasure to be here. Good morning.
How are
you? Good morning. I'm as good as could be expected.
So you, too, were not there at the March in Washington in 63. I don't know if you were there on Saturday.
I was there briefly on Saturday, and I was at the 20th anniversary in 83, the 30th in 93, and I think that was the last one before this past Saturday.
But I just want you to open this up, because one thing is just to reflect on this day. I don't know if you heard what we said at the beginning of this
program. I did.
This is also a day, by the way, let me just throw some things out as you get ready to say that. The Second Pan-African Congress was called, that we mean Du Bois participated and others in Europe, beginning of a whole movement. This is a lot of things happened on this day. Your reflections on all that?
Well, first, I just also not only in this day, but this month, and I just want to, you know, briefly mention the tradition of Black August and emanating out of the George Jackson prison reform, you know, prison abolition movement, celebrating all the radical and revolutionary activities that have occurred in this month historically, some of which you just mentioned. I would pick up with what I heard you say a moment ago, that most of the people in the audience or in the crowd on Saturday were more progressive than the speakers themselves, which to me was a big problem and somewhat depressing, in that the leadership, then those who convened this march and this week's series of celebrations, have walked us back from where we were as a movement in 63, certainly where we were by the end of his life, politically, ideologically with Dr. King. Those last 5 years of his life are always omitted. And those should be what I think we should commemorate more than the 63 March and I Have a Dream. Because as he would eventually say, his dream had become a nightmare in the face of structural inequality, the intransigence of white supremacy and liberalism and capitalism. So, I mean, these were kinds of the emotions I was feeling on Saturday.
You know, and I was thinking, let me just throw this out, and like Kay and John jump right back in here. One of the things I felt being there on Saturday, the same feelings, but almost turned a little bit, because I was actually, I didn't expect more than what was happening on the stage to happen on the stage. Mm-hmm. Some of the speeches were fine, but I mean, just, I didn't expect more. But I was inspired by the people who were there. Yeah. Because they were young, a lot of people in their 20s, a lot of teenagers, a lot of families bringing their children to this march. And the signs and the fervor people had, Kay, were just, they were much more revolutionary and radical than what was up on that stage.
Well,
and
I
that was
there.
The hope to
Absolutely.
Me that I loved on that day.
I was down there as well. I just wanted to add to what you were saying. I'm not sure if the speakers actually moved us back. I think they were trying to move us back. Mm-hmm. But because of the spirit in the crowd, we did not move back. People left the march. I mean, I marched as far as I could, many miles until I got tired. I know you have many miles to go before you sleep. But I sat down. And when I sat down, and I sat down with people around me, whether they were older people or younger people, they were on fire, not about the speakers, but about what this moment represented. Perhaps it was a coming together and reminding us that when you have this collective group working towards change and progress, it can happen. It won't be stopped by the speakers. In fact, we may have to move past the speakers to get to the point where we want to be.
I would just say that you're right, but that step beyond them is made that much more difficult is really my argument, and that they're really, as others have been saying, not enough and not getting enough attention, but others have been saying that, you know, what Malcolm said about the 1963 march being a farce on Washington is more applicable today in terms of what was going on Saturday and certainly what's going on today, which really should be seen as a scandalous event.
Well, I want to add, what bookmarked between what happened on Saturday and what's happening today, we had the March on Washington 50th Anniversary Youth Summit on Monday at the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And we had 450 students from all around the country meeting us at the U.S. Capitols. Politicians were there, invited educators. Everybody from Ernest Green was there. Chuck McDough, who was one of the founding members of SNCC. You know, we had Carlotta Laws Lanier. We were there, and I was one of the speakers, and we were talking about getting past the I Have a Dream speech, getting past that moment and understanding that next 5 years of King's life when he began to talk about poverty, not forgetting it was a march on Washington for jobs and freedom. The jobs part gets lost. I mean, there were 22 million people that were unemployed in 63. It's about 60 million now. So that part of the dream has not been fulfilled. King says it has become a nightmare. I would argue that over time we have seen that nightmare live out. So perhaps Saturday and today, what happened at the Capitol on Monday and at the museum yesterday, we had young people who were on fire about change.
But even with
John, you want to jump in on this?
Well, yeah, it's interesting as I listen to what the speakers are saying, because, you know, by the time we get to the point that became pivotal in the movement, which is when the children were seeing hosed in Birmingham, most of the people who were involved in the marches by this time, and this is that 5 years that the brother talked about between 63 and 65, most of the people have pretty much abandoned King. I mean, no adults really want to be going to jail then, okay? That is why when you read the Kerner Commission report, there are so many children, the 75% of the people arrested after 63 were children below the age of 21. So that's something that you have to look at. And one of the things about this whole celebration, and I agree with the brother who was talking about the speakers, listen, everybody was trying to get that catchphrase that would become the I Have a Dream, you know, response, that call and response thing. But actually, where the planners of this march failed was that they didn't realize that the people were there to be together. They wanted to be together. So this whole idea of a whole lot of speeches and all the other stuff, there was no catchphrase to come off. And I really hope that President Obama don't come out in his speech just reaching for a catchphrase today.
I think they were trying to do, at one point they were trying to make the stand your ground, the twist that they were putting on the stand your ground phrase.
Right.
I think they were trying to make that stick. which I took as, but I was actually kind of offended by that too. Like, it was, because it wasn't enough of a direct response to the increasing police violence in this country,
right.
to the structural police, to the every 28 hours that where black people are being killed by the police in this country. Those kinds of, that kind of, it just sort of skirted around the issue. And again, I am in full agreement that most people, and that's what I do think was the positive of Saturday, that most people do want more progressive change than they're being given by their leadership. But it's unfortunate to me that I don't see enough venues for that radicalism to go. They're being corralled. We're all being corralled back into these sort of safe, and everything was, you know, reduced back to voting again. So it becomes sort of a Democratic Party promotional campaign, as opposed to looking at this 50 years of post 1963 leadership as having largely failed us. Those who were there speaking have failed us and should be condemned and criticized, not being praised, not be given praise for having reconvened us again.
Well,
yeah.
Go ahead, Kay.
I was going to say condemned and criticized and moved out the way.
Yeah,
I
mean, no question.
One of my concerns about Saturday, and I agree with what John said, I felt that there was so much focus on trying to find the next I Have a Dream speech that nobody actually said anything. King did not plan to get up. In fact, they didn't even want him to speak because he was so young and unknown. Mm. He didn't plan to do the I Have a Dream speech. It was Mahalia pushing him.
Right.
And when you read the speech, you actually can see, when you read the beginning of the speech before the I Have a Dream call and response, it was not a great speech. It was a good speech. It was a speech like Saturday. But something happened when he moved into I Have a Dream. That's what we remember.
But
that did not happen on Saturday.
The replication was the omission of James Baldwin, the rewriting of John Lewis's speech, in the omission of Harry Belafonte or even Cornel West or Tavis Smiley.
Right.
Those voices were omitted
from this
rally.
Let me just also throw something in here, and I hate to be the one to drop the incendiary device into the discussion. But why wasn't Minister Farrakhan invited to speak?
Yes.
There are a lot of people.
My son asked the same question. He said, what about that man from the Million Man March? Is he going to be there? I mean, because he was able to bring, whether it was a million men or five men, he called for it and people went down.
That's right.
Let me throw a twist on both these things here, because I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but I'll just, my job is to twist it a little bit.
Twist away.
So part of it, you know, I think that many people could argue in retrospect against what Malcolm X said about the farce on Washington in 63.
Right.
And that, because that march was beyond itself. That march that day inspired a lot of people to fight and change. And it was this, there was people from the SNCC and the others who were there, that we were there, that it was a, there were a lot of radical revolutionary feeling that thing that pushed that day. That day was a jumping off point. And I agree that the issue of people who were left off the podium on Saturday is an important issue. But as when some people told me they were not coming, my response to them was, sometimes people who are progressive and have certain visions of where America might be do themselves more harm by being so sectarian they don't want to show up.
Right.
Because the people who, working people from across America, showed up. You know, these young dreamers took a bus all night long from Florida.
Or walked down from Philadelphia.
You know, families coming up from Chicago, an old couple we met coming up from South Carolina. I mean, it was, and these were working people there making a statement. Those are two things I think that are really important about these two events. And I have no great expectations about what's going to happen today.
No, but I mean, that's my point, that the speakers from the podium on Saturday, and certainly what we're going to get today, I mean, Bill Clinton and Carter on
and
top
Carter,
of this, I mean, this is just absurd.
Keep laying it on here.
That they are here to do just what we're all in various ways saying, to blunt the progressive element and the force that exists within this
society.
I'm
surprised they're letting Carter speak.
Right.
Well, he's certainly more progressive now that he's not a president than he was at the time.
Yeah, His last couple of years have definitely been more progressive. But again,
we're talking about commemorating a speech and a day that is often symbolized by Dr. King, and that symbol of Dr. King has been intentionally created to deny us access to the man himself and to his real politics and to the increasingly radical movement that he was more emblematic of at the end of his life. That all of that has been omitted from all of these ceremonies, and that's what I think is going to have a negative impact impact on all of this progressive force and element that does exist.
But I think the information about King is out there. Not I think, I know. His speeches are out there. The tapings are out there. We need to challenge our teachers to move beyond the set curriculum. Teach all the information about King. Teach the more radical speeches at that time about King, when he spoke out against the war, when he spoke out against poverty, when he really took up the working class issues beyond just let's hold hands and sing We Shall Overcome, because we haven't overcome. I'm not sure if we will ever overcome, and I'm not sure what we're doing in D.C. today about overcoming. Mm-hmm. When you add certain speeches and speakers to the platform, you're telling us it's not about coming together and moving beyond the present reality. It's about moving backwards, and we should not be moving backwards.
I would like our listeners to join with your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook page or tweet us at Mark Steiner. I'll check those tweets in a minute. 410-319-8888. What do you think about this day? Emmett Till, the March on Washington, Barack Obama being nominated, this 1921, this Pan-African Congress took place in Paris. 36 people from the United States, 39 from the continent of Africa. It was an amazing meeting that took place in that era. This is the day that William Zantzinger was only given manslaughter for killing Hattie Carroll. This is the day that Quinn Oak Park was integrated.
Right.
A lot went on August the 28th. Right. Emmett Till was brutally murdered and tortured to death in Mississippi. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts? Let's get a couple calls in here.
Okay.
Bruce, you're on the air. Hi, Bruce. You there?
Yeah, this is Bruce.
Yeah, I know. I said, hi, Bruce.
Yeah, so I love irony. Here's been the irony with the modern civil rights movement. So what Dr. King said is great, and he's a man of vision, and I agree. But so you're talking about all the sacrifices, all the millions of miles of march, and the real martyrs like Emmett Till and whatever, and Hattie, I can't remember her full
name. Hattie Carroll.
So anyway, all the sacrifices that the blacks and people of color and whites that also participated in that movement, all the struggles they went through, all the trials and tribulations, all the burdens, and now because of voter ID, it's considered voter suppression, when in reality, if they could deal with all those burdens to get people, blacks, to register to vote and how important the vote was, why should it be such a burden that they actually have to go to the Department of Motor Vehicles and get a state-issued voter ID with their license? I wouldn't consider that a burden at all. That's not voter suppression.
I'll tell you why it is. because, first of all, it's never happened. It only happened. Voter ID laws were only in the segregated South.
Right? Yes.
it's the only place they ever existed.
Well, you also had poll taxes.
I have been voting in this country since 1972, I think, was the first time I voted, I think. And we never had nobody asked me for ID. I walked in, registered to vote. My name was there, and I voted. That's how simple it should be in America. Yes. Register the same day you're there. Many places like Texas, Alabama, Mississippi, places like Ohio and Wisconsin even, you have to drive hundreds and dozens and hundreds of miles at some points, especially in Texas, to get to a place where you can even get an ID. Mm-hmm. And over 40-50% of poor people in America don't even have access to a car or vehicles. That's what
or unable to take the time off of work.
Right, or take up the time off of work.
To be able to get there.
That's why it becomes voter suppression.
If I could just quickly add, I think it's important, again, because King's name is always evoked here, that if you read Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, his last full-length book, you will notice how little time is spent on the issue of voting. And I think this has become another one of the problems inhibiting progressive change, that so many more options can be included in the array of methods of struggle for progress in this society, in this world, that we are encouraged only to focus on voting, which leads us right back to the two, you know, established parties and all the people that back them similarly. And then we end up getting caught in the same sort of vicious cycle and trick bag. And so I think it's important to revisit not only what King was saying and others were saying, but also, you know, look at the way they were looking to either use the vote or to manipulate the system in a variety of other ways.
As so, well as moving past race. I just want to add that.
We're going to take a break here.
Okay, we're coming right back.
We're going to go out with Emmett Till by Bob Dylan. We're going to think about Emmett Till on the next last half of this conversation. Tony and Alice, you're the next two callers up. We're going to definitely get to your calls when we come back. Stay with us as we reflect on August 28th and all this day means in its breath. Stay with us.
Not so long ago, when a young boy from Chicago town walked in a southern door, this boy's fateful.
tragedy, he should all.
Welcome back. And that's another thing that was missing on Saturday. Singing.
Mm-hmm.
The singing was missing on Saturday. That's what's really – we wanted this – we did end up in a march that was an offshoot by accident where it did take place. The end of the march on Saturday, Valerie and I found ourselves – because they tried to hem everybody into this little space to march up on Saturday, this little way led by police horses and motorcycles. So you have to step through horse poop to march. And so what we said – I said, I'm not going in there.
And no sacrifice is too great.
We walked on the side with a lot of other people. Several thousand people also walked on the side with us.
Mm-hmm.
We got to the end, and all of a sudden there was this chant going on. Guy was on a bullhorn going, Trayvon. And that crowd was going, Martin. And then no justice, no peace. And all of a sudden we realized we were no longer on the main body of the march.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There were 500 to 1,000 people being led by a group who I don't know who they were, but it doesn't make a difference.
Yeah.
Marching up, taking over the street, no police in sight, closing down traffic, marching to the White House where they rallied. I was just that was the greatest spirit of the moment that day, this kind of spontaneous. And people who did that were young and old and just marched. That was a pretty amazing moment. We are here with Dr. Jared Ball here from Morgan State University, Dr. K. Wise Whitehead from Loyola University of Maryland, and John Milton Wesley to talk about this day in history, August the 28th. And there were a bunch of other things we didn't mention that happened that day. The ministers getting arrested in New York that happened the same day in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
75 ministers and laymen, blacks and whites, arrested after a prayer demonstration in downtown Albany that took place. So much happened on this day. It was just kind of an amazing juxtaposition. Let's go right to the phones and come back to our guest at 410-319-8888.
Oh,
I'm sorry. What?
Yeah, Mark?
Yeah.
I just wanted to say right quick on what you said about the song. I thought it was so interesting that at the end of the speeches, there was a song that was a rap, funk kind of, I don't know what they were doing. But I really thought that what they should have done was to go into the vintage songs from the Civil Rights Movement.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's.
Let me jump to the phones here. Tony in Annapolis, you're on the air.
Absolutely.
Tony, you're on the air.
Hello? Let me jump to the
you're on the air, Tony. Can you turn down your radio, please? There you go. Cool. Welcome.
Hello.
Welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. God, I'm nervous.
Don't be nervous.
Thanks for being there today and helping keep us all informed. I was just kind of... to not take anything away from anything that's happening out there, I wanted to, my personal feeling of growing up in D.C. and kind of, you know, I'm 50 and seeing a lot of changes go down and kind of been up and down in my life. It seems like the racism that's coming is more about haves and have-nots than they used to. About yellow, black, white, red, and the you know, if doesn't matter if somebody moves on to, you know, your block, whether they're, you know, the same color or not. If they're the same economic status, then we tend to be fine with them. If they're not, then we tend to want them off our block. And I hope that somehow gets addressed in everything that's happening this week. That was my comment.
No, it's a great comment, Tony. I think that one of the things we talk about here a lot is the intersection of race and class in America. And I think we had a program not long ago. One of the things that was said in this program was about a new high school being built in Prince George's County in an upper middle class African American neighborhood. The residents of the neighborhood didn't want a neighborhood not far away to be part of that school district because it was working class and poor folks. Mm-hmm. So class is an issue.
No question.
It is.
Mark, I just, without a doubt, I think one of the most unique uses of class, look at what happened with the Zimmerman jury. You know, one of the things that happened was that a jury was picked that had nothing in common with either the young lady who was Trayvon's friend, any respect for the so-called experts who came in. I mean, you know, what did the juror say? She didn't even know what this lady was talking about. She couldn't hardly understand her language. So that's a class thing. You know, we used to think of class, the issues being just colored with race. But class is a real important issue here.
You know, even... Go ahead.
Which is one of the issues I wanted to raise before we went to the break, that the conversation after the I Have a Dream, when you look at King's later speeches, it did even begin to move past the race issue. Instead of being divided on the black and white, it really started talking about class, because class, there are some intersections between race and class, but there are a large population of white people who are in poor in this country as well, who are economically impoverished. So I think, yes,
yeah.
I mean, we have the idea that we have to think about these things and think about how we can move past race. If we remain focused on race, then the conversation remains stilted. It can never move forward. It's always about, where do we start with? What do we look like? And what can we do to get past that? What about this other issue, this economic issue that we've been struggling with, and we haven't come up with very good solutions since that time, since 63?
Well, I mean, again, that's why if we're going to commemorate King and all these events, we should commemorate the fact that he had spoken at least privately, glowingly about socialism, and then publicly about redistributionist politics. And then we should also commemorate the fact that he was saying we need to have a permanent tent settlement. That's what they were organizing in 68, not these brief events. And and then lastly, I think, you know, Gloria Richardson, those of us listening to WEAA would have heard her yesterday on Democracy Now. And I think she made a great point that was leading towards this issue of class, where she was talking about Barack Obama's difference in his experience growing up versus the average black male or black person in this country, that leads to some of the issues that prevent him from being the kind of leadership that we would want, and allowed him to become the kind of leadership that he is now. And that very important class difference is not only apparent in what's happening today, but what happened Saturday. Yeah. Most of the speakers were from the class that represents the economic and political elite and the military elite of this society.
Yes.
So the idea that they would be speaking on behalf of or in commemoration of a 50th anniversary March on Washington should be a scandal. I mean, it should be an absolute scandal.
And let's go back to the phones here real fast. Okay, but let's have a quick thought, Kay.
No, I was going to say this. The same thing I raised. I did an op-ed in the Syracuse Post talking about the same issue that Gloria Richardson raised. Why can't we move past that? Why are we not looking at Barack Obama's history and understanding that some of the ways that he sees things are based upon his very unique history, which is not the same as many men of color in this country?
The other side of that, though, is there are men of color like Al Sharpton and others who did run this march.
Yes.
Whose politics have been compromised a lot over the years.
Oh, but and I think their time has come and gone.
I think we
need a new generation of leaders who are within the movement at this moment and still have the fire and fervor and not willing to do whatever they need to do to move forward. I mean, Al Sharpton has a robust career now as a political commentator, which always surprises me whenever I see him do that. But he has moved away from the heart of the movement.
But he's also been described as a surrogate for the White House. He's a paid surrogate for the White House. This is decidedly in opposition to what King and that leadership was looking to take, where they were looking to take us.
But it's also in opposition to where Sharpton used to be, because it used to be about the idea of agitation, and that you can't agitate and work for the same organization you want to agitate
might
against.
Argue that Al Sharpton was about agitation, was also about Al Sharpton.
Yeah, well,
a lot of people would argue that.
Well, that has remained.
319-8888. Let's go to the phones. And William, you're on the air. Hi, William, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Okay, thanks.
William, you're on the air?
Yes.
You're on the air, William.
Oh, okay. Hello.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, I am. My name is William. Okay. My comment is about what is being done.
If you turn down your radio and just give us your thought, it would be great.
Okay. Yeah, we cut it pretty off. My comment is about something that is affecting the black people of Baltimore, and I guess the black people of most major cities, and white folks too. And I think more damage is done to the black people to the legal system of their properties and their homes being taken away through this tax sale system.
Yes.
Where, you know, these lawyers play all kind of shenanigans and with the complicity of the city and the courts, and the equities of people, their hopes, their dreams are taken away you are not allowed to even be in the courtroom when your property
I think that is an issue. As a matter of fact, the reason we're having the folks from Richmond, California on the show and having more on the coming weeks is because they're actually in that city stopped foreclosures. And the banks are suing the city because they've stopped foreclosures.
And it's also why it's another scandal that Obama appointed Penny Pritzker as the Secretary of Commerce, one of the biggest slumlords in the country and prime mortgage scandal leaders in the country. I mean, but anyway.
let's go to Dave in Baltimore. You're on the air. Dave?
Okay.
Dave, you're on the air. You can turn on your radio, please.
Okay.
You're on the air, Dave.
Hi. Mark, thanks for this discussion. I have a dream. I have a dream that nonviolence would be placed in the center of the discussion by one of the speakers today, maybe Carter, using airstrikes in Syria, try to approach it through negotiation, instead of an officer using his taser thinking his taser was a gun and shooting Oscar Grant in the subway. Yes. Let's try to think a way to defuse violent situations and use peaceful means, no drones, no force feeding in prisons. My dream, and I wish Carter would say something like that, who questioned democracy in our system.
That's a great call.
That's a great call.
And we'll see what he does today.
Mm-hmm. We'll see. I think what's interesting
he
is...
He might. You never know. He just might.
He might. I mean, he did win the Nobel Peace Prize, but of course so did Obama. But Carter does.
He has come out a lot around Middle East, Palestine, use of violence and force. And, and the only president we've had in a long time who actually served in the armed forces.
Right. So Carter might come out.
He might.
I think my concern is that when we start talking about hopes and dreams, that there are things that you can't actually work for. I mean, when you think of a dream, you think of something that's not tangible, something you can't plan for. That when I asked around on Saturday, you know, what are you marching for? I mean, people, it was all kinds of things. I'm marching for better jobs. I'm marching for better housing. And I'm marching for a different kind of coffee at Starbucks. Like, it just kept going on and on and on with all of these goals. But if we have all these goals and we don't have leaders or organizations in place to take the goals and come up with the plan, then they're just dreams. They're just ideas that never get realized.
Yeah. Let me ask, this is something I want to ask before we go back to the phones here, all three of you. One of the things we were going to talk about today, and we are talking, which we haven't hit on just yet, is Emmett Till. And 58 years ago, this young boy was tortured to death, and his killers walked away. And in some ways, people are trying to make, Trayvon Martin, Emmett Till, while there are some linkages, the periods of time are very different and what happened is very different. But what does Emmett Till say to us today? What you're teaching classes. Both of you, that's right. You're both college professors. And John Wesley is a teacher without being a professor. He is. What would you say to your students today about what Emmett Till means for us now?
Well, what I have done, and particularly with the controversy over the Lil Wayne song, making that reference to Emmett Till, that ridiculous, that abusive reference to Emmett Till.
Right.
And by the way, Al Sharpton has a book contract on the same company that puts out Lil Wayne's music. So, I mean,
I knew you had to go there.
I mean, I can't help it. I mean,
as soon as you said Lil Wayne, I said, oh, here comes the book contract.
You can't help yourself. But the way I've actually used it is to make more of a direct connection than I think maybe you are, Mark. With
please,
this.
No, go that, ahead.
That,
go ahead.
That both to me represent state-sponsored or accepted violence against black people. And I do think that despite the need to focus on class and other issues, that there is a particular anti-blackness to this society that continues to crop up. So then, and the response was very similar. You know, we had sort of obviously the Emmett Till trial was a show trial. And then what we had with Zimmerman was largely a show trial as well that was backed up even by the president saying, we're a nation of laws, a rule of law.
Right.
We have to accept the law.
Right.
Again, returning us back to what Derrick Bell, the late great law professor, was pointing out before he died, that we already have in place public policies that are tantamount to the random roundup of hundreds of black people who would be taken to a secluded place and shot.
Right.
So in this sense, we have, the continuity for me is pretty strong and clear. And that's the way I've tried to use it in my classes.
I added as well, and I talk about this perceived criminality among the black male
body. That's right.
What is this danger of walking and moving and breathing while black?
That's a great point.
The assumption is that no matter where you are as a black man, you must be either on your way to do something illegal, coming from doing something illegal, or planning something illegal in your mind. Either way, you're in a state where you are outside the laws of this country. I think I have kind of a before having kids and a after having kids response to Emmett Till. Mm-hmm. My father talked about Emmett Till a lot as a child, and that's the only story from the Civil Rights Movement that would make him cry.
Amen.
He said because he could not understand when he thinks about a young boy, 150 pounds, although he may have been heavier, he was young, with a speech impediment, that this idea you can come to his home, take him out of his home at gunpoint, go kill him, drive him around in your truck, show his body to someone, and still walk away and be free.
And
so when my father talked about that, I heard it as a child. I mean, I knew the story of Emmett Till, but I was living in D.C., Chocolate City, thinking, well, that's so far away from me.
Right.
As a mother of young African-American males coming out of this Trayvon situation, I set my boys down and said, we have to talk about what it means to be guilty just because you are a black male. And you have to understand, I'm not going to teach you like Emmett Till's mother when she said, if a white person comes up, get down on your knees and beg them for forgiveness. I'm not teaching you that. But we need to talk about what happens when you get into certain environments. And the assumption is you're already doing wrong.
John?
Yeah, well, it's funny, as I listened to this, I went back, Mark, and I'm listening, and my mind was focusing just on Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam and what it was like to, you know, to see them and be around them.
These are the men
and
who killed Emmett Till.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, to live across the street from them. And I remember, you know, one of the incidents that I had with J.W., and I was in the store at Rouville. And he was, I guess, kind of playing around with me or something. And I ran. And when I ran into the door jamb of the store, and my nose started bleeding, and I ran home. My house is right behind, you know, right across the street and behind the store. But anyway, he did not understand when he went to see my grandmother, because he knew that he was in trouble. He did not understand why I was afraid of him. And I always found that, as I've grown older, very interesting that this guy had no idea why, as a black child, I was afraid of him. That's very interesting. Why did they say they killed Emmett? Well, the Milam brothers said that they killed Emmett because they didn't like the way he talked to them. He was not afraid of them. So one of the things that I think is important that we help young black boys understand is that the perception that they may have of themselves and what they are doing is not the perception that the people who are observing them have of them and what they are doing.
And I think that's something we should also teach all children, because to only teach black children that you have to be concerned about what other people observe in you, which means you can't be yourself. You always have to be playing a role so that other people can be comfortable with you, people that are not people of color. That's part of the problem, that we're always the ones who have to play a role. We're always the ones who have to adjust to make other people feel more comfortable. When is the day going to come when you can move and be a person of color without having to play a role, without having to be assumed guilty, even if you haven't done anything?
Let me go back to the phone chair. We've just said a lot of very important, heavy things here around this, and it's one of the few times I've seen my dear friend Jared Ball almost speechless.
I mean, yeah, I mean, hearing just that part of the story is, I mean, that's heavy.
That is very heavy.
I wasn't ready for that.
410-319-8888. Tyrone, you're on the air. Hi, Tyrone, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing, Mark?
Very well. Welcome.
You know you're going to have all kinds of different viewpoints about this, Mark. And sometimes, you mean, I wonder, you mean, are we today just as delusional as we were 50 years ago about this situation? Because looking at the grim realities of things, I don't know if we made progress just to find ourselves in an even worse dilemma or worse problem. You know, Frances Crutch Welding, for those who know who she is, a psychologist and a lecturer, and wrote many books. She say for the whole population of black people in this country, only 40% are pro-black, meaning those who have a love for black people and would rather die and go to their graves for the love of black people. The other 60% has an attitude that in order to make progress and get ahead, in order to succeed and become successful in life, they have to join in with white folks with hatred against their own people. They have to turn their back on their own people in order to get ahead. You know what I mean? That's kind of crazy because back 50 years ago, I think we had a lot more love for each other than we do now. And Dr. Umar Johnson, he says now there's a war being waged against us, an educational war, a medical war, a prison industrial war being waged against us, an economic war, and a class war. So I wonder, have we really made progress just to find ourselves in a worse place?
Thank you, Tyrone.
I know the study that he was talking about. I mean, that to me, I've always felt that the research was flawed. These are sweeping generalizations to say that 60% of the black people in this country walk over their own people to get whatever they want. These are sweeping generalizations. It's hard when you do percentages and you're talking about all black people, even when you look at her data. I was always concerned about that. I am not sure if we have waited around and have worked to find ourselves in the worst situation. I think that we continue to push up against this mountain, and that the more we work to overcome one mountain, another mountain gets put in our place. And I sometimes wonder if we sit and we look at the mountain and we look at how big whether the mountain is the mountain of unemployment, the mountain of rising illiteracy rates among black kids, which, you know, according to Mary Wright Endelman, we're talking, what is it? She said 64% of African-American kids by the third grade are unable to read at that grade level. These are the statistics from last year.
Well, but
so these are mountains.
But
here,
one could lead from the other. And whatever right. might be flawed in, I haven't seen the research, in Cress Welsing's research, her conclusion, I think, is largely justified by, if you just look at the behavior of most people, which could be argued is the conclusion or the expected result of the kinds of mountains, the repetitive, you know, the constant mountains being placed in front of us that would encourage certain patterns of behavior. I mean, this is what Fanon always talked about, was the inertia of colonialism that created the so-called apathy among poor and colonized people. And if I could just shamelessly plug very quickly, we have a for free downloaded interview, the first time ever that Dr. Cress Welsing and Marimba Ani ever sat and discussed anything together. A good friend of mine had conducted that interview, and people could check that out at imixwhatilike.org. But I think that she raises at least some very good points. And I would only add that what Dr. Johnson is saying about these wars is nothing new. It's a continuation of an unfinished and incomplete revolution.
But wouldn't you argue or agree that there are issues that are happening in the black community where it's one issue after the next? I mean, Daryl Michael Scott, who's the president of ASALA, once said, you can die for black people every day because there are always issues in the black community that
right.
you can put yourself on the line and die for, because it's just so many issues.
And that's all I'm saying. This is the permanence of
yes.
the imposed inequality that causes these. That's all I'm saying.
I think that we can actually maybe produce a show in the coming months around Creswell and other people's thinking and have a real debate on that. I think
we
should.
We'll talk
about it.
I think it's
worth having a discussion
yeah.
just about that. And John,
or have her include her.
Yeah,
she's here.
I mean, have her defend her own research.
I mean, yeah.
That would be an interesting hour.
Yeah,
that would be a really interesting
mm-hmm.
hour. We only have like 4 or 5 minutes left. John, why don't you throw your thought in here before I try to get another caller in for the end of this discussion?
Well, you know, I just wanted to say again, I think the sister makes, you know, the speaker makes a very good point. The fact that, you know, we need to share that kind of information with all children because, you know, there's something that I've seen, Mark, and I don't know whether or not it's just an illusion on my part. But, you know, I have seen, it seems to me that since the Trayvon Martin verdict, I have seen a more pronounced case of young black men in particular with their pants down. And now it seems like not only is it a case in which they're without a belt, they're actually wearing the pants with a belt now with their buttocks showing and their drawers showing. And somebody said to me, that is a statement that they're saying, kiss my butt. And I don't know whether that is.
I mean, there are a lot of arguments around why, you know, sagging exists, and a lot of responses and various responses to it. All I ever really want to say about that is that sagging pants have nothing to do with the way black people are treated in this country, and that if we pulled our pants up and all wore suits and cropped our hair and did everything we're told to do, we would still be treated as we are.
And the other part is that every young generation has has had an element that's addressed to go in to be in your face.
Right.
I mean, every young generation has done that, right?
Yes.
That's right.
On one level or another, that's part of being young.
That's right.
That's what people do.
That's right.
And
I mean,
as you get older and you get a job, you begin to pull your pants up because you can't go to work like that.
Also,
so,
you know,
you tend to grow.
As you get older, you don't want to be showing your butt in public.
You know, right. And nobody wants
everything
to see
everything gets less
it.
Attractive.
Yes,
that's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Come on.
So, well, we had a very heavy discussion. It was good to end it on a little,
no doubt.
Yes,
a little
light note for this moment. I want to thank all of our guests. I love having them on the air with us. John Milton Wesley, dear friend, who is, by the way, working on a Fannie Lou Hamer project with our staff that we hope to have out in the next few months. We'll be traveling to Rouville, Mississippi together to finish that project and bring it back to everybody. Dr. Jared Ball, assistant professor of communications here at Morgan State. Co-editor of Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, and author of I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifesto. Jared, always great to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, assistant professor of communications and affiliate assistant professor of African and African-American studies at Loyola University. Glad you're back in the studio with us, Kay.
Thank you. And for people to check my blog, kwisewhitehead.com, for the release of my new book on the life of Emily Frances Davis, a freeborn black woman from 1863. That's due out in the spring. I also have a new lesson plan coming out through the National Visionary Leadership Project, Camille Cosby's company, all about the civil rights movement and how you can teach it from middle school up to the university level.
Kwisewhitehead.com. Congratulations. Yeah.
Have to have you back on for that.
Yes.
I'd have read that if I had known it.
I just added it in. When we work together, I always have something else to add.
Thank all of you for calling. I'm sorry we couldn't get to everybody's call. We're going to take a brief break, come back. We're going to hear what's latest in the city paper for this week. We're going to jump into the question about Syria. And then we're going to be talking to Will Haygood, who wrote the article, The Butler. And actually, the original article he wrote, which we'll be talking to him about, as well as the movie, was really, in some senses, more powerful than the movie itself. So we'll talk to him about that at 10:30. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey everyone, it's your man HD from the Audio Infusion, inviting you to meet me at the 10th Annual Collective Minds Festival, Sunday, September 1st, 12 to 7 p.m. at Druid Hill Park. This one-day family event celebrates dance and house music. Family and children are welcome, free admission. For vendor and general information, go to collectiveminds.org by Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Interested in donating your vehicle to an organization you believe in, like Public Radio WEAA? It's simple. We'll tow your vehicle, and you receive a tax deduction in support of the great music, talk, and cultural programming you enjoy on WEAA. You'll also receive a one-year membership. The number is 1-866-789-8627 or WEAA.org. Thanks.
When was the last time someone sat down and answered all your questions about your kid's asthma or your mom's aching bunions or those conditions that throw a wrench in your sexual performance? I'm Marilyn Harris Davis. If your answer is, not lately, you haven't been listening to Urban Health Beat, where we talk you through the challenges of living healthy lives and explore the prevention, intervention, and treatment of all that ails you. Join me for Urban Health Beat, Wednesdays from 7 to 8 p.m. here on Public Radio 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Hello, I'm Ernestine Jones, host of the Gospel Grace Sunday Brunch. If you want to hear those smooth, mellow classics and inspirational gospel songs, then tune in on Sundays from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. So don't forget, that's Morgan State University Radio, Gospel Grace, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
So we pray.
Public Radio, 88.9 FM, the broadcast service of Morgan State University, WEAA, Baltimore.
Wednesday on the Mark Steiner Show. We'll have a round table.
Peace, this is for... Peace, this is Faraji Muhammad. Tune in every Friday night at 7 p.m. for Listen Up, as we offer a new perspective about the people, the issues, and the ideas that influence our communities. So think deeper and hear differently every Friday night at 7 p.m. with Listen Up, here on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Listen Up is provided by the MTA, committed to keeping Maryland communities connected with dignity and respect.
Reporting live for WEAA 88.9 FM. We're actually standing in the security line for a press and about to get checked in. And I wanted to let you know about added speakers for today's Let Freedom Ring commemoration and call to action. They include Caroline Kennedy, Mayor Vincent Gray. Also, Governor Martin O'Malley will be on the podium. And we're going to have some interfaith service led by Reverend Dr. Bernice King. Right now, they're ready to check me through, and I'm going to let you know that WEAA will be bringing you live updates of today's commemoration, the 50th anniversary March on Washington, this historic day, live on WEAA 88.9 FM.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all with us on our way to our conversation today. Let me remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, you can go to MECU.com. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. Baltimore's Credit Union, MeQ, www.mecu.com. Before we jump into our conversation about Syria and the West and Syrian gas and the rest of that, we are going to talk to Baynard Woods, who is with the Baltimore City Paper, talking about the latest issue, senior editor of Baltimore City Paper. Baynard, how are you?
Doing real well, Mark. How about you?
I'm really well. I'm good, man. So tell us, give us a scan. What's happening this week in the paper?
Yeah, so this week, I think it's one of our most important feature stories that we've had in a long time, The Summer of the Gun, which is a long photo essay that J.M. Giordano has been doing for all summer long, going out to every shooting, or almost every shooting, that he's able to get to, and taking pictures and talking to the people who are left behind after this rash of gun violence this summer. And he's collected just some extraordinary pictures, all black and white, and classic photojournalism style, and
amazing
mostly
work
at night. And they're really, really powerful pictures. And so we have a couple dozen photographs that are really documenting what's been happening in the city this summer with, you know, nearly, at least recently, unprecedented gun violence. That's our really big story. And if you go online, you can also get audio for that. And they're making something beautiful out of this really tragic situation. We also have a really exciting review of M.K. Asante's new book, Buck, Morgan State professor, and about his life in Philadelphia when he was involved in gun violence. And one of his best friends was a victim of violence, and the way that that affected him, and then the way that he went on the path, found literature, and ended up where he is today at Morgan State. And also we have there's a new record label in Baltimore, Strong Records, that's really doing fascinating work. Some of the people behind Out of Your Head and Soul Cannon that mixes instrumental and rock music with hip-hop. And they're having a record showcase tomorrow at The Crown with a whole bunch of really great bands, Leap, Mimetics, Chris Pumphrey Quintet, and Talk Show, which really do some interesting work and actually talk with the guests and then mix improvised music with that. So that's a little bit of what we have going on this week. Plus, what's happening with country and folk music in the area, a review of Azra, the new restaurant in Little Italy, a Persian place that seems really exciting.
Where is that?
It's right off President Street in Little Italy, and I'll give you the address right here. It is at 806 Stiles Street, and it just opened up, I guess, a month or so ago, and really may be able to bring some new life back into Little Italy with other places closing down. They're at least getting a real good start on it.
Well, we're looking forward to this issue, and actually we're going to bring some of these stories to you in the coming, with the City Paper, some of the stories we're going to bring to the airwaves in coming weeks to kind of bring those stories to audio life here on the air. We are going to be doing a piece with the Summer of the Gun, and working with Giordano on that and the People's City Paper to kind of bring some of those voices he met to the studio here to keep that. And it's an amazing piece. You should not, you need not to miss that. You need to get to the City Paper and to get to the City Paper's website to check that out. Ben Wood, senior editor for the City Paper. Thank you so much, Ben. Talk to you very soon.
Right. Yeah, talk to you soon, Mark. Thanks.
All right. Bye bye.
All right. Have a good one.
You too. We're switching gears now, and we're going to look at what's going on in Syria. Any moment now, and people say as early as tomorrow morning, there could be a missile strike on Syria. It's caused a lot of controversy. Most of the polls that have come out in America have said Americans are opposed to it in huge numbers. Most Europeans are opposed to it. Clearly, most of the Arab world is opposed to it. There are a lot of questions here about the sarin gas that was used, and we'll talk about that during the course of this half an hour. They're saying Assad did it, but did he do it? Are there other forces at work here? What should be our response? We are joined here once again by Dr. Adil Shamu, Associate Fellow fellow at the Institute of Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., Senior Analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, author of Equal Worth, When Humanity Will Have Peace. Dr. Ali Zagheb, a Palestinian-born businessman, political observer, who was a professor at Birzeit University before he was shown the back door out, has made a successful life despite that. And Sabith Khan, executive director of Manasa, a think tank and policy shop focused on youth issues in the MENA and South Asian regions, currently pursuing a PhD at Virginia Tech in planning, governance, and globalization. I don't know if all of our phones are working just yet, but if they are, everybody's here. Great. So, gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
So let's go around the room here, and let me start, Ali, if I might start with you. You just came back from Palestine.
Correct. I was in Palestine, Israel, and Jordan.
And you were in the midst, at least, of the conversation taking place in the Arab world on the ground and all this taking place. So, hey, talk about that, especially in terms of what's going on in Syria now and what conversation is taking place and what your thoughts are.
You know, my thoughts, Mark, are I am absolutely positively against starting another war in Syria. You know, the history, you know, even the recent history with the Iraq war, Colin Powell, when he was Secretary of State, and I have a lot of respect for the gentleman, goes in front of the United Nations and shows the world falsified information about Iraq. The same with Syria. Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations, today said, we need to give this more time. People in the Middle East, in Palestine, in Syria, in Jordan, in Israel, everybody, I don't want to say everybody, but most people are saying, why do we need another war? Most intelligent people say, why do we need another war when we are not finished with the wars that were started, you know, 10 years ago? The consensus is wait and see who did the atrocious things, who did the chemical and the sulfur burning of innocent civilians, and then decide. That is what the intelligent people in the Middle East are saying, and I hope that people will listen also here and in Europe.
Sabith Khan, your take on what is happening in Syria and what should be the response?
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
A pleasure.
Sure. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sabith, yes, go ahead.
Sure. Mark, quickly, I agree with Ali to a certain extent, and I believe there's a difference, qualitative and quantitative difference between Iraq and Syria. I think these are very different situations, and I'm not a war hawk, I mean, just to be clear. I see myself as a liberal, and in that sense, despite that, I believe this case calls for a shift in the present paradigm where, I don't need to state the obvious, there is a huge imbalance in terms of what's going on. And I think U.S. intervention to a limited extent would shift the balance and perhaps force Assad to rethink his position. And perhaps if that leads to a transition, I think that would be the goal accomplished. Though that hasn't been the stated purpose, I believe a certain limited intervention on behalf of the U.S. with regional buy-in, Arab League has not come on board yet. But I believe with the U.K. taking the resolution to the Security Council, I hope things will change.
So what do you think the response should be?
From the American side?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think U.S. should intervene. I think there should be limited military strikes. Perhaps, I don't know if there should be no-fly zones, but if called for, I think there should be military intervention to a limited extent with the stated objective of, shifting this power balance and transitioning perhaps to a different government.
Adil Shamu.
Well, I think this is an event, the intervention, if it comes to be true, which all likelihood it will, it's related to the global situation rather than just really we are going to intervene in Syria. When the U.S. interest, as perceived by the government in power, as the administration of the time, perceived their interest is good for them to go and intervene in Iraq or good to go and intervene in Syria, they find really a reason to do it. Because our interest, what are our interests? Our interest is to give a strong message against Russia that we will protect our interest in Middle East and bud out of it. A smaller message to China that you should know Middle East is our territory. You go elsewhere. But the biggest message is really left to Iran, that Iran is going to be withered away from its influence in Middle East. And what we are doing, we are now going to punish one of your clients, Syria, which is the most important really client for Iran. So they want to make sure that Iran's influence is brought to size. And why we're doing that is our military intervention will serve to assert our strategic interest. Oil issues, again, this is the world's 70% of oil reserves in Middle East, and to help our friends in Middle East, like Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. So, unfortunately, we haven't said, what do we expect next? They say it's not regime change.
Well, let's talk about two things here. I'll pick up regime change in a minute, but let me throw out something first. I want to talk about what's going on in Syria and if there even is an American response. We'll talk about that, but let me come back to that second. First, this breaking news you just sent over? That the Syrian Electronic Army, whoever they are, just hacked the New York Times website and hacked 9 websites, including New York Times, Twitter, and Twitter's image service, TWIMG. Some visitors to the affected sites were redirected to hacker-controlled service that attempted to launch drive-by malware attacks. So that you all should be aware of that, what's going on right now. But anyway, I mean, there's a lot of discussion about this chemical attack. But and there's no question that it took place. Doctors and Borders are very without Borders, very clear that these are the people they've treated were victims of a chemical attack. But do we know who did it? Do we really know? People are saying Assad did it. They're saying they didn't do it. Could it not be people who have stolen stockpiles? Could be with Al-Qaeda. Could be any other group that have done this to foment an attack to weaken Assad's regime. Not that Assad is a stellar guy. Nobody's backing Assad.
No.
But I'm saying we don't really know who did this.
Well, it shows when our interest comes into focus. And that Jay Carney, after 4 days of the last use of the chemical weapon, said it's too late to go and investigate. Whereas the UN inspection team, which we voted for them to go and inspect, was 4 months later. 4 days was too late, and the inspector team was already on grounds in Syria to shorten the time, basically. And they did go there. So I am not sure who did it. I am not sure really it happened, to be very honest, even though, because it's symptoms. The UN inspectors usually take samples of clothes, earth, ground, and from buildings. And organophosphates, since I'm a scientist, I know a little bit about neurotoxins. Organophosphates remains in the debris for months to come. And we are not waiting. The same thing we did in invasion of Iraq. We did not want to wait for the inspectors to report.
So let me turn to Asabeth and Ali for a minute,
Mark,
here.
Can I say something, please?
Is this Ali?
Yes,
Ali, yes, go
Ali,
ahead.
Yes.
Ali, go ahead. Ali, go ahead.
You know, it's really a very unenviable position to be put in to try and defend Bashar al-Assad, okay? That is something I would never do. In fact, I think I was on this show almost a year ago. And I have no liking whatsoever to this dictator or even his father. Having said that, we do not have any proof that he did this chemical warfare. And Alessandra Vellucci, the United Nations spokeswoman in Geneva yesterday, said we need 14 days to find out exactly what happened and who did it. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says we need more time to sift through the facts and come to a resolution or to a firm statement who did what. Why the rush all of a sudden to start? 100,000 Syrians have been killed in this, and now we want to start war from the sea, from wherever it is, and kill more Syrians? It is not like this will be a surgical strike against Bashar al-Assad and his prime minister, Mr. Waleed al-Muallim, who was, by the way, at one point the ambassador in the United States, or his ministers. This will hurt more Syrians. This will spill more Syrians from their homes and cause more damage. I do believe it is essential for us to wait, and the Europeans are clamoring to have a war. They always do that, but when the U.S. gets in, they do not want to send any foot soldiers. Look at Iraq. Look at Afghanistan. It's the American boys and girls who end up going there fighting and getting killed while the Europeans are pontificating. And so, that's exactly what is happening now.
Sabith, your thoughts about this? I mean, can you say that we do know that Assad did this? I think it's an assumption at this moment.
That's true, Mark. I agree with both the speakers, but I think there's a difference again. I think the chemical attacks, chemical use of chemical weapons itself, in my mind, is irrelevant in the sense that the sheer proportion of people killed. I think, as I wrote about 6 months ago in an op-ed, the case for intervention was stronger 6 months ago than it is today. And I think this is more of an occasion for decision. I think the red line, as President Obama has called, has just, it has pushed people to intervene rather than, you know, it hasn't triggered the response itself. So I think this instance itself is more of a catalyst rather than being the real cause of intervention, in my opinion.
Perhaps that's true, I mean, we can debate that, but does that mean that we should send cruise missiles flying today or tomorrow into Assad's military forces?
Not immediately. As I said, I think people should, the U.S. should wait for the U.N. Security Council to come back. And perhaps I think if there is no, I mean, I don't think there will be a shift in either China or Russia's position. I think, yes, despite that, I believe there is a case for limited intervention. I do strongly believe that military targets are kosher. There should be targeted strikes against, of course, chemical facilities as well as even military targets. I think that will hopefully bring a shift in the thinking that's going on in the Assad regime.
Yeah, I opposed interference in Syria from the beginning, and the reason is there was clear indication from the very first 6 months that if the opposition wins, the Alawite will be slaughtered. There is two, three millions of them. The Christians will be slaughtered and the Kurds will be slaughtered. That's not insignificant percentage of the Syrian society. That's about 40-50% of the Syrian society. And the winners would have been Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda. currently, if there is a regime change, and that's one reason we are changing our mind about regime change, about Assad by the United States, is that Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda will become the most two powerful forces in Syria. So we are really not thinking through what the consequence of this interference is. Even if there is zero reaction from these groups and Iran, I'm saying is we are handing over Syria to the Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda. And that will be a disaster to our foreign policy in Middle East. It's poor choice, and I don't know who is pushing for it, but it's clearly there are forces pushing for intervention in Syria. Moreover, all our interventions never stops at the point of intervention, because what happened if Assad says, okay, fine, I'm still living, and I'm going to do exactly what I want. I mean, by action, not by words, he'll say that.
Right.
And what are we going to do? We're going to bomb him more. We're going to kill more innocent people. Then we are going to have no-fly zone. Then we're going to have boot on the ground. That's really what's going to happen. The Arab streets are going to be really toppling their existing government now, which some of them are allies with us. And this is one reason. Do you think these corrupt government didn't come and say, yeah, go ahead and bomb Syria, not because they love the opposition, because they or Assad, because they love their royal power to stay in power from their own streets.
And I think, Ali, in some ways, America right now is the American political structure is at a total loss about how to respond. So all the upheavals going on in the Arab and Muslim world.
You know, I totally agree, and it really is not. I do not blame President Obama at all myself. In fact, I think he is doing a fabulous job, and I guess I'm the only one who is saying that now. by staying out of this, it is like a cesspool over there. There are so many problems, and like my colleague, Dr. Shamu just said, we do not know who is going to have power in Syria if Assad is gone. And again, I'm going to preface that by saying I'm not defending Bashar al-Assad. But I do recall when we were in Afghanistan against the Russians, we dealt with bin Laden, if everybody should remember that. And the U.S. supported bin Laden and gave him arms and gave him money and all that. And look who the biggest snake in the history of the United States turned out to be, bin Laden. And right now, we have so many elements, fringe elements, extremist elements in Syria and in the Middle East. And these elements, believe me, they still carry the torch of bin Laden, and they would do damage to the United States and its allies any day they can. We have to be extremely careful whom we help, whom we do not help, and whom we give arms to.
I think it will increase the hatreds to us and terrorism against us. It's just we do not need it in this stage of our economic and political life in the United States. Our economy is teetering all the time, and this is going to cost us $1 billion probably a month.
More. What
at least.
And we also don't
Mark,
know.
If I may, Mark, sorry to interrupt, but
no, go ahead,
the question we should. Yeah, the question we should really be asking, I think, is what is the alternative? I mean, this has gone on for, what, close to 2 years or maybe more. So another 2 years of civil war?
Well, I tell you what we could do. What we could do is...
Let him finish your thought. We have about 4 minutes left.
Sure.
So quick, finish your thought.
What we could do. We said we did nothing when there were 4 million refugees, 4.5 million Iraqi refugees. So let's not, you know, thump our chest. We gotta do something. We didn't do anything. We let the Iraqis suffer. And Syria can solve its own. We had 4 year civil war. The United States, Russia had. France had it.
I'm making primarily is a humanitarian one, and I hope I'm.
I support
here.
All humanitarian
help. We only have a few minutes. Sabbath, finish your thought.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a very strong humanitarian case to be made. The UN has failed in its responsibility to protect. So has the Arab League. I think the regional powers have really failed. And I think the UN really needs to step up. And unfortunately, that's not going to happen. So I think, in my opinion, the only chance for peace in this case is unfortunately, through limited strikes. And I hope, and I really pray, I mean, of course, my sympathies are with the people and with the thoughts that both the speakers have shared, that we really need to think through the consequences, of course. But I think this sitting, letting the status quo continue is not going to get us any results. And I think, as I said earlier in the show, the only chance for peace would be some limited action and regional buy-in, and hopefully the UN steps up to the game.
But a question people might have also, what power does the UN really have? The UN has, it's going to be stymied because Russia is not going to allow any intervention on the part of the
and
United
China,
Nations.
And China, by the way, Russia and China.
Right.
They're going to say no,
I mean,
they're going to block it.
When I say UN intervention, I mean, assuming the U.S. goes ahead with the strike, I think the U.N. definitely does have a role to play in the post-conflict situation that emerges, hopefully, maybe a year, 2, 5 years, who knows how long this might take. But I think in a post-conflict situation, when things are a little more settled then, I think in terms of democratic transition to whatever regime there is, and one hopes that it's not an extremist regime, I think that's where the international bodies would step in and do the part that they have to. Of course, we don't have a model right now. I mean, Iraq is a terrible case. we are all aware of the cases that have gone wrong. But one can hope that
doesn't
go that way.
We're just about out of time. So, Adil, you have a quick thought, but well, we really are out of time.
It's unfortunate. You see, the Syrian revolution started correctly, and I wrote several articles in its support. What happened is it got hijacked by extremists, by the billions of dollars Saudis and the Qataris and the Bahraini pumped into it. That's really the problem.
We're going to have to take a break here, but we're going to come back to Syria in the coming days, obviously, maybe come back tomorrow and Friday after we see what the response is and continue this because I think it's a very complex situation that we need to know more about. Attacking Syria now could just blow back in our faces faster than we realize. We want to thank our guests, Dr. Adil Shamu, Dr. Ali Zaghab, and Sabath Khan for joining us here during this half an hour. We're going to go out on this break listening to a Syrian protest song written by Ibrahim Kashush, who was killed by the Syrian government in 2011. So I'll leave you with that. We're going to come back with Will Haygood, who wrote The Butler. Stay with us.
WEAA is winding down the 88 Days of Summer at the Chestertown Jazz Festival. Jazz in the Sculpture Garden at the BMA, Jazz Under the Stars at the Silburn Arboretum, the Collective Minds Festival in Druid Hill Park, and the Baltimore Book Festival at Mount Vernon Place. We'd love to see you there. We're closing out the 88 Days of Summer with all the details at WEAA.org. Support for WEAA is provided by the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture, presenting Ashe to Amen, African Americans and Biblical Imagery. On view now through September 29th, from Ramir Bearden to Rashida Bumbre. Divinely inspired works in this exhibition explore and investigate how biblical interpretations have influenced African American art. Details at rflewismuseum.org. And members like you. Thank you. Interested in donating your vehicle to an organization you believe in, like Public Radio WEAA? It's simple. We'll tow your vehicle, and you receive a tax deduction in support of the great music, talk, and cultural programming you enjoy on WEAA. You'll also receive a one-year membership. The number is 1-866-789-8627 or WEAA.org. Thanks.
Hello, this is Anthony McCarthy from The Anthony McCarthy Show. As you know, WEAA isn't just radio, it's public radio, where the bottom line is public service, made possible by listener support. Listener support keeps WEAA programs on the air. Listener support also makes it possible for WEAA to maintain its editorial independence. Your listener support makes WEAA a better radio station. To help, go to WEAA.org or call 443-885-2075. And thanks.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you with us here. We're about to have a conversation we've been looking forward to here on the Mark Steiner Show with Will Haygood, author of The Butler, A Witness to History, and the Washington Post article that inspired the movie that was written actually November 7th, 2008, A Butler Well Served by This Election. He's also a Guggenheim and National Endowment for Humanities Fellow. And Will Haygood, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here again, Mark.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook page where we've put Will Haygood's original article for you to read before the show, or tweet us at Mark Steiner. Well, this is, I tell you, I saw the movie. I read the book that you wrote as that went with this movie.
Yep.
And then I reread again this morning before I went on the air your original article, A Butler Well Served by This Election. And I have to tell you this, just your quick thought on this. The article you wrote in 2008 was amazing.
Oh, thank you.
It was really a history. It was the beginning of the history of black folks in the White House, but it was in some ways even to me more powerful than the movie itself.
Well, one thing that I am very proud of both the movie and the article was that the article went way back, with Booker T. Washington and his, nighttime secret visit to dine with President Theodore Roosevelt as the first black dining guest at the White House, and that created an uproar. Southerners especially hated the idea that a black man was dining in the White House, and my article talked about all that and went right up to the present.
The one piece in the article I thought would have been lovely to have made the movie because it would have added some context was the story you put in the article about John F. Kennedy being aghast at his White House dinner.
And
tell that story because I think that was that said so much that he didn't want Sammy Davis Jr. and Britt to be there together as a black man and a white woman, and it wouldn't allow them to be photographed.
Yes, this was a event in 1963, an event at the White House to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. And Lewis Martin, who was a Democratic stalwart, had added Sammy Davis's name because Sammy Davis was at the March on Washington, and he supplied a lot of money to the people in jail during the marches down in Selma and in other southern cities. So Sammy, he was married to May Britt, the Swedish actress, and he wanted to bring her to the White House, and he did. It was President Kennedy who had thought that Sammy's white wife had been scratched off the invite list. And when he saw them in the ballroom, he was aghast. He was livid. He turned beet red, and he turned to some of his staffers and said, no one must take a photograph of them. He feared the reaction of Southerners that an interracial couple was at the White House. First Lady Jackie Kennedy rushed upstairs. She was so upset with the president for him being upset. She was very mad at him for the rest of the day.
I think that would have been a great scene in the movie.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You. Yeah.
So, what did you think of the transformation of Eugene and Helene Allen into Cecil and Gloria Gaines?
Yes. I was very comfortable with it. I think Lee Daniels has made a movie about the essence of Mr. Allen, and I think he has captured that extraordinarily well. It's also a movie about the president, about he served eight presidents, in real life from Harry Truman to Ronald Reagan, the movie really only explores his relationship with five of those presidents. Otherwise, it would have been like a 4.5-hour movie. But the five presidents who are portrayed, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Reagan, were at the White House during some very tumultuous years in the nation's history. And in their stories, against the backdrop of the Civil Rights Movement, against the backdrop of Cecil Gaines, Eugene Allen's home life, I think makes for a very, very powerful movie. Much of it's fact. All the historical things really happened. You know, the dates of the Selma March and the assassination of Dr. King, and all those epic page one headline moments really happened. The family dynamics, there's fiction interwoven into the family dynamics.
Mm-hmm. About the Gaines family, you mean?
Yes, right. Yes, with the Gaines family. The for instance, goodness, and I hope I'm not uttering a spoiler alert for those who haven't seen the movie, but in the movie, the butler has two sons. In real life, he only has one. Now, in real life, his son, Charles, did go to Vietnam, and he survived. That was always very, very, very rich, Mark, to me, that the butler walking down the hallway to take a tray of Pepto-Bismol or food or whatever to President Johnson was staring at the very president who had sent his only son in real life to Vietnam. I mean, so you can imagine what his wife in real life, Helene, what she would think when he came through the door in the evening. Have you talked to the president about getting my boy out of Vietnam? And the son, Charles, did tell me that his father wrote him a letter and said, son, I would like to help you, but I'm really not as close to President Johnson as I was to President Kennedy, and so I can't do anything to shorten your stay in Vietnam.
There's several things I wanted to ask you, and folks, I encourage you all to join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com or any other way, with Facebook, tweet us at Mark Steiner. Many of you called in and had a great deal to say when we had our raging discussions on the movie The Butler. We'll read some of those comments on the air. But I'd like to hear what you think now as you talk with Will Haygood, who wrote the article, A Butler Well Served by This Election, that created this movie, that was what this movie was based on. He's also author of The Butler, Witness to History. So join us here, 410-319-8888. One of the things before I ask some specific questions that actually came up in some of our previous shows about this, to hear your response to them, we had a lot of support for the movie, and there was a lot of critique, and so I wanted to throw some of these things at you and see what you think. But one of the things at the end was interesting, the way Helene passed away on the eve of the election that you wrote about in your first article in 2008, that was, again, one of those scenes that, to me, was even more moving than what happened in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just how that happened. That was just, again, reading it again after all these years, it was almost just drove me to tears.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it was, Mark, I had went to visit them Friday, that Friday, and this unknown butler from the back pages of history. I spent the whole day with them Friday. And they took me down to the basement. He did, showed me all these treasures. And it was an amazing story. It really felt like I had come across the story of a lifetime. Aside from standing across from the prison in South Africa watching Nelson Mandela walk to freedom, I just don't know what other story of mine stands up to answer this one. but 2 days later, Sunday, her son, Charles, he comes over to visit. And his mother meets him at the door and says, Charles, I'm so happy. Son, I'm just so happy. And he said, Mama, why? What's going on? Have you hit the lottery or something? And she said, no. A writer, Will Haygood of the Washington Post, came by, and he's going to write a big story about Eugene, about my Eugene, your father, who served his country faithfully for 34 years. And she said, I'm so at peace now. And there were some other people in the house. And she said, hey, everybody, I'm going upstairs and I'm going to bed. I'm just so at peace now. She went upstairs, went to bed that night, and died. And the next day was the election of this country's first African-American president. Very, very, very haunting, touching story. It just is. It still moves me deeply when I think about it.
It does me as well. I just was, it's just the way you put it about his shuffling on the bed and finding her, he was awake, but she wasn't. That was just a very powerful moment. Let me open the phones here and also read some of the things that came up in some of our other discussions. I've really been anxious to hear your response to some of the to some of the things people had said in the past and are on air. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Abdul first, though. Abdul, you're on the air. Hi, Abdul, you there?
Yeah.
Welcome.
My name is Abdul Aziz. I know Mr. Allen, his wife, his son, because his son's married, Charles is married to my sister, Otasiana. And I saw the movie, and I've been listening to these interviews. I'm trying to figure out who is he talking about, because I know the family. All that I saw was fiction.
Do you want to be specific about what you mean?
Specific. In the movie, it's more like he's idolized. He's this real understanding guy, but that's not the real Eugene. That's not when you talk about Charles, man. Charles is he's with the was with the FBI, man. He's a crook, man. I'm trying to figure out who you're writing about.
All right, well,
because I know these people. I know them. All right, and they aren't who I saw on the screen.
Well, the two things. First, let me let Will respond, and ultimately just say that, of course, these characters on the screen were fictionalized characters. They weren't; they were completely different people. Much of the story was different from some of it was based on it. What's your response to that, Will?
Well, I'm not going to respond to to any attacks on. Any family members of any sort. I'm sorry, I just thank the person for going to see the movie.
So what? That's the movie. Now we had some people on here. We had a roaring debate on the show about the movie. The people who loved it and supported it, and what was in it, and people thought it was the kind of thing that was a catalyst for discussion. But some people argued that it tried to squish too much history into a short space of time, that it kind of sanitized the history of the civil rights movement, that the whole Zelig thing was out of place, and that it was made to make white people feel good. What were your response to those things when people say that?
I think that Lee Daniels, Laura Ziskin, and Pam Williams, all great producers of this movie, have made a movie whose time has come. There haven't been a lot of civil rights movies in this country, as we know. The ones that have been made, often the camera focuses on the white characters. And, of course, we all know there were very brave white citizens in the civil rights movement. And more than a few lost their lives, were murdered as well as blacks. But when it comes to cinema, I think it's important in this movie that the camera stayed focused on the black man, the African American family, Yes, he was a butler because this is real. The butlers and the maids made money in this country if they worked in homes or if they worked at the White House, and many sent money to relatives still living in the Jim Crow South. It was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. himself who said, if you're going to be a street sweeper, be the best you can be. If you're going to be a shoeshine man, a garbage man, be the best you can be. Mr. Allen happened to have been a butler, started out as a dishwasher and rose to the highest level, maitre d' at the White House. And I think that's a very, very prideful thing. It's almost biblical in a way to me. The last shall be first. The movie is not about Eisenhower, Kennedy, Reagan, Nixon, any of the other presidents he worked for. It's about him. It's about his life. And, yes, it is an exploration of Black America during these tumultuous times and years. And I, for one, think that it does its job extraordinarily well. It made the president cry, as we've seen in the stories this morning. So anyway, I would suggest that people give the movie a chance. Go see it, you know, and before they attack it, you know, which seems to be very fashionable these days to talk without having read the book or seen the play or seen the movie. You know, that seems to be a hobby, and you know, I think the more information you have, the more astute you will find yourself in talking about movies, books, or plays, whether you like them or not.
Yeah, you have to see it first, man. We went to see it just about when it came out. We prepared for our conversations, and having looked at your book and then reread your story, and it was a. This movie did one of the things we said in this program in our last debate on it was that no matter whether it was people who liked it and didn't like it, was that this movie sparked a discussion.
Yes.
You couldn't walk out of this movie without wrestling with some issues.
Right. You're exactly right, Mark. And I think my grandparents and my mother, all born in Selma, Alabama, that civil rights soaked city, they escaped or got out, fled within the borders of their own country to Columbus, Ohio, where I was born. And I think that anybody from the South seeing this movie is going to be very, very, very moved. I think a lot of school teachers have been saying that we have to do more to teach our children about this these years in American history. They're raw. They're terms of history, they're fairly recent, it's, you know, it's the wound that has been searing at our nation since slavery, and we've come a great distance in this country, a beautiful distance, and that's because of people thinking in a righteous manner, Black and white, old and young, to move us forward. And I think this movie captures some of that journey, and I think that those moments of the sit-ins and of the urban riots in Washington, D.C., and of the butlers in the White House wanting better treatment, and of family dynamics and family pain. I think every family, Black or white, is going to be able to identify with, you know, children. Some children want to go down this road, and other children want to go down that road. And especially in Black America, before the Civil Rights Bills were passed in 1964 and 1965, you had older Blacks, many who were afraid of their kids, children, college students going down south,
right,
because they could be murdered. And then what have you got? Then in their mind, they still don't have a civil rights law, and now all they have to do, I mean, now all they have is to go to the cemetery every other day or week and visit their child who's dead. I mean, it's a very bone-crushing reality that many parents had to deal with.
And I'm going to go to the phones to get this, to try to get a call in here, a couple of them coming in at 410-319-8888, because I think that some people didn't think those scenes were real, but the scenes around the Black family in that period were very real.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anybody who lived in that world knows it was real. People were interacting with the other. And I remember in the Civil Rights Movement, so many other parents, Black and white, didn't want their kids in the movement. They
right.
did not want their kids in the movement.
Yes.
Period.
Yes, and I think sometimes people put, well, not a rosy picture on the movement, but, you know, I think sometimes they think it was just hand-holding and singing
yeah,
songs,
no.
We Shall Overcome. But it was very, very, very dangerous. There was no federal law to protect you. Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, the three civil rights workers murdered in Mississippi, and there's a reference to them in the movie. They went into harm's way because they wanted America to live up to its constitution, and they paid the ultimate price for it. They were murdered on a back road in deepest Mississippi, and there was nobody there to protect them. This is fact. These are you know, these stories are in the history books. Not enough people know about them, but these are facts. You know, this is
right.
You know, this is what happened during recent history in the 1960s. It was a very different nation, and I think this movie reminds us of all that, and it also reminds us of the beauty of the nation, that we had the maturity, the courage to move forward. We aren't perfect, but a lot of other countries look inside our country and say, you elected a black man to the highest office in the land. You judged him by the content of his character, not the color of his skin.
Let me try to get a call in here, Will, before we end our hour together. 410-319-8888. Philip, welcome. You're on the air. Hi, Philip. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, how you doing today, sir?
Very well.
I refuse to watch this movie, especially with us having a black president in office. And, you know, people see, or this movie is a visual reminder of black man being nothing more than just a butler in the White House. And I'm tired of us always going back in the past and showing where these lowly positions. I think it would have been a lot better use of showing, you know, another powerful character other than some subservient butler in the White House. Whereas, though, you know, we could have taken stories from Thurgood Marshall and how people of color progress past being maids and butlers. And he also made a reference in The First Shall Be Last. Well, if you want to misquote the Bible and say the first shall be last and turn it into, he arose to the position of butler, what does that say to our young black kids, that they should be proud to arise to butler, you know, being a butler?
Okay, but let me just stop. Only interrupt you, Philip, because we only have literally 3.5 minutes left, and I want to let Will kind of respond. Will?
Yes, well, he rose to the position of Maitre D', so he was over the entire White House staff who looked after the first family. So that's very important. That's an exalted position within the White House. If he was offered that position, he felt very proud to have that position, and he served it with honor. And it's not like during the 50s he could go out and get executive chef jobs. Many of those jobs were closed to him. He put food on the table. He had a wife and he had a son, and he was a good man. He worked for 34 years. He never missed a day of work. There's majesty about that. I think it's very sad when people look down at maids and butlers. My grandmother worked as a maid in Selma, Alabama. I love her as large as the sky itself and a million times more because she got on her knees and scrubbed floors to support her daughter, my mother. And I see nothing negative in that. It's work. It's work. People had to work. People worked through bad times in the economy. There were Pullman porters, men on trains. They were gallant men. There's, and they supported their families. They lived the American dream, and you pursue that dream as best you can.
Well, Heywood, I wish we get to these other callers, Jennifer, and I wish you're calling in. We can't get to calls. We're out of time, correct? Your support, calling in to support the movie, we appreciate that. We couldn't, are we out of time, folks? Yes, we are out of time. So I apologize to anybody getting any more calls that came in late. But I want to thank Will Heywood, author of The Butler Witness to History and the article that got all this started that he wrote when he interviewed the original family of Butler Well Served by this election. Will, always great to talk to you. Thank you so much for this. And I want to congratulate you. Your day has come as well. And I think that it's well deserved after all the work you've done all these years to have this recognition for your work.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's been an honor to be with you again.
Take care of yourself.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you all for listening in and being part of the show today. I want to thank you all for being with us and remind you on the way out of here that the Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late, don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's national foreclosure settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or 877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. You can go to our website, steinershow.org, and link to the work and other ideas from our guests and see what they're doing. You can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.
Hey everyone, it's your man HD from the Audio Infusion, inviting you to meet me at the 10th Annual Collective Minds Festival, Sunday, September 1st, 12 to 7 p.m. at Druid Hill Park. This one-day family event celebrates dance and house music. Family and children are welcome, free admission. For vendor and general information, go to collectiveminds.org by Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Supported by the U.S. Forest Service and many other national organizations, Get to Know has launched a nationwide contest for youth from ages 19 and under to get outdoors and share their nature-inspired experiences through art, writing, photography, video, music, and more. Rediscover the great outdoors and connect with nature. For more information, gettoknow.ca.
Peace, this is Faraji Muhammad, inviting you to join me at the Baltimore Book Festival, Sunday, September 29th at 3 p.m., as I talk with actor and television host Terrence J. about his new book, The Wealth of My Mother's Wisdom, at the Bank of America Literary Salon. His book highlights the lessons he's learned about sacrifice, courage, dreams, and perseverance. WEAA is a proud media sponsor for this event. For more information, baltimorebookfest.org.
John Tegler here in